Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Today's episode is the first in a special two-part series with a guest whose work has shaped the way millions think about land, livestock, and leadership. Alan Savory is a legend in the regenerative agricultural world. Founder of the Savory Institute, developer of the Holistic Management Framework, and a lifelong challenger of convention. From growing up in war-torn Rhodesia to commanding combat tracking units and later reshaping global agricultural theory, Alan's story is as unconventional as it is urgent. As Alan says in today's episode, quote, "Without agriculture, you cannot have a choir. You cannot have a church. You cannot have a university. You cannot have an economy. You cannot have a government. You cannot have an army. You cannot have anything. It is the very foundation of civilization," end quote. In part one, we cover his early military service, his time as a young wildlife ecologist tasked with protecting massive swaths of African rangeland, and the origin of holistic management. How it was born not from theory, but from a lifetime of ecological and military observation under fire. We also dive deep into how institutional ego, flawed beliefs, and academic dogma continue to stand in the way of solving global desertification and food security challenges. This isn't your typical ag conversation. And it's not meant to be. It's bold, unfiltered, and driven by a mission that started decades before most of us even heard the word regenerative. Let's get into part one with Alan Savory.
I grew up in Africa in a unique situation, I'm actually just going to shortly be publishing a memoir describing that entire situation. It's a very muddled one. But out of it came the ability for us to address the root cause of most violence, emigration, desertification, ultimately climate change today. Out of it came that from, and I point out how it could never have come from one person, me or anyone else, never from any university, any environmental organization, any government, nor from any one country. Nor in any time in history. It just came out of a unique situation of small population, a country only 12 years old when I was born into it, dying empire, dying colonialism, and years of war. I was 20 years from the first shot I saw fired in anger until I was out of the army. But I was also opposing the generals, leading political party, against them, developing scientific work, and tracking is the origin of science, according to Liebenberg. And I'm just condensing all this rapidly. And I was just lucky as a young 20-year-old to see that we had a serious problem because I saw biodiversity being lost in wild areas in Africa, which I was in charge of. As a 21-year-old, I was in charge of an area greater than the United Kingdom. And I was working with some of the world's top ecologists. They had no answers to the problems I was seeing, so it changed my career. And then I had the fortune to be an ecologist, spending 20 years in war and tracking people, commanding a tracker combat unit, etc. So it was just a unique situation. And then exile that brought me to America and far-sighted bureaucrats in the USDA, agriculture, through the Soil Conservation, commissioning me to train 2,000 American scientists in the work that was known I was developing. And that was an incredibly creative period with some very brilliant people, caring people in the US. DA. And finally, by 1983, we could understand the problem, could see that there was a remedy. And I published our first textbook That's still contained.
Yeah, and that textbook being the holistic management approach.
No, not an approach. It's 100% practical. You don't take an approach to pregnancy, otherwise you never get pregnant. It is literally management which is the root cause of the problem.
Yeah.
And we found what was flawed in all human management, two little glitches, like two glitches in the software in our brain, which is a brilliant computer, if you like. And we discovered those two little glitches, and if we correct them, we get very, very different results. And I'm very pleased to be speaking to vets, because the people who bear the brunt of this are the military, because poor land, poor people, social breakdown, violence, war. And this is what I learned so much as an ecologist and an officer in the army. It is the military that ultimately bears the cost.
Yeah, there's a lot of connection points there, and I do want to unpack, to the extent that you're willing, some of that early unique experience. That country in Africa where you grew up was Rhodesia.
Yeah.
Right? In modern day Zimbabwe today, and that unique time, from my understanding, was during the Rhodesian War, right, where the Rhodesian Party was led by a minority white group. And they were...
No, the Rhodesia Party was led by me. The Rhodesian Front was led by an extremely racist, dictatorial, authoritarian Ian Smith. Yeah.
Ian. Okay. Well, rather than me screw this up, why don't you lay the situation and groundwork for folks that aren't familiar with this conflict and how you found yourself as a 21-year-old in the army?
Well, no, I was in the army even earlier than that, because we had a system somewhat similar to the American system. We had a small standing army, much like Britain does, and a very large territorial army. Bulk of our male citizens were in the army one way or another, like your National Guard. And so in the system we had, by the time I left high school, I had gone through cadets, each boys' school, boarding and day boys' school in my country. Each school was virtually a battalion in the army already. And by the time I left school, I'd gone through Cert A, Part 1 and 2, basic officer training from Sandhurst. And I'd completed that before I left high school. So already knew, you know, was already firing machine guns and rifles and everything. We were literally geared to be a battalion in the army. And then I went through further training as our situation worsened. So it wasn't optional with us. All young men were in the army or the Air Force or the police. We didn't have a Navy.
What was the political situation at the time, as you were going through this early training?
Well, at the beginning of it, we had a very, very productive, creative country, very proud of our record. We would be regarded as racist today because we were colonials. And so everything's judged in a woke sort of manner today. And I've had to deal with that in the memoir, but I've chosen to stick to the language of the time, what we thought, how we acted at the time in the memoir, and to hell with the world, people, they can do what they like. That's how we were, and we need to face it. And we had a very, very proud record. I was part of that. It's what part of what motivated me. It's not well known, but we had been a self-governing colony on the same basis virtually as Canada and Australia. And we were the very first country to declare war on Germany with Britain before Canada, Australia, South Africa, any others did. And our actual contribution of manpower with our small white colonial population was greater even than Britain's. But we were divided, our small numbers were divided into all theaters of the war by Smuts and Churchill, General Smuts and Churchill, because our losses had been so great in the First World War and the slaughter in France, that we, our small country, just couldn't stand the loss of a brigade, for instance, would have meant loss of a lot of our men. So we were divided in, spread in all theatres of war. And in fact, it's lovely. I'm going to London shortly for a Spitfire ride. Friends have contributed for my 90th birthday.
Wow.
And one of the things, while I'm there, I stay in the Special Forces Club, and I'm going over to the Victoria Club, where they've invited friends and family and so on of the officers and men of Peacock Force, part of the 14th Army behind the Japanese lines. And a godfather and mentor of mine who got me into the game department, and Edgar Peacock was a Rhodesian. So three of the top officers were Rhodesian or ended up being Rhodesian, and they were all friends of mine and mentors. So it's wonderful that's coinciding, and I'll go and hear more of the history of Peacock Force.
No kidding. There is this interesting connection between the sort of SAS type tracker units that you were instrumental in founding in Rhodesia and the SAS Special Forces in Britain. But can you maybe talk about where this initial idea or recommendation came from that you made to the federal prime minister at the time about preparing for an impending guerrilla war by recommending that officers go through early tracker training?
Yeah, it's not quite like that, but it'll come clearer.
Please,
in the
please.
Thing. Yeah, yes, Roy Valensky, Sir Roy Valensky,
yeah,
was the federal prime minister, and I, as a very junior officer, I think I was a lieutenant at the time, wrote to him, appealing to him to let us train our army for guerrilla warfare, not because you're always training for the last war, not the next one. And we weren't fighting a conventional war. And I was very aware of that, but most of our officers weren't. We were training for the last war. So we wore boots and gaiters and long trousers and bush hats that looked fantastic on parade, but got knocked off in the bush and were impractical. And I wanted us to be the first army, actually in the history of the world, as far as I know, where we actually train trackers and train tracker combat units, because I had spent my early life tracking man-eating lions, and I'd learned that if the trackers were fearful, the closer you got to your enemy, the more they lost the tracks, and it was just nothing but fear. And so I realized I have to become a tracker myself and put them back on the damn tracks and say, stick to it. And then I realized, of course, now I'm into guerrilla warfare and I'm tracking humans, so it's the same thing. So anyway, I did eventually succeed in getting us to train trackers, guerrilla anti-tracking units, mixed groups. That went on, morphed into the Sulu Scouts later, a unit that had some wonderful people in it, but overall behaved extremely badly, that I wouldn't permit as long as I commanded the tracker combat unit. But we don't need to waste time on that. I'd much rather talk about agriculture and vets and where we go and the future, because I think vets getting into agriculture and getting concerned could do tremendous good for the United States.
And there are a couple of sort of growing initiatives right now that I do want to share with you that I believe speak to that sort of broader thought that you have. As we sort of move out of this, connect for us and the listeners how you began to realize that what you saw as in the Rhodesian Army and during that time of guerrilla conflict led you to believe how just important agriculture is and was to a society.
Let me try. It wasn't the tracking in the army that led me to that. I was a wildlife ecologist, and I began to realize that biodiversity loss leading to land degradation, which we call desertification because it's destroyed more than 20 civilizations covered by desert sands, etc., leads to megafires, fueling climate change. These are now feeding on each other. And I hit on that very early, and that management by us professional people was the root cause, not any of the things we were blaming, but institutions and professional people almost never admit error. And I insisted that we admit error and so on. So it was like throwing a pork chop in a synagogue. I've been very out of favor and condemned and vilified by a great many people, etc. But I stuck to it because basically, let's look at it this way. Without agriculture, you cannot have a choir, you cannot have a church, you cannot have a university, you cannot have an economy, you cannot have a government, you cannot have an army, you cannot have anything without agriculture. It is the very foundation of civilization. Right now, throughout history, we've abandoned our cities when agriculture could no longer sustain them. And now this is a global problem. So let me just to give military people some idea of the significance of this. A while ago, I was invited to Israel, and I went down to Beersheba. Many people might remember the mounted infantry, the Australian mounted infantry charge on Beersheba. There was a movie made about it. Oh. Well, I was down at Beersheba, and I was with Bedouin Arabs. Now, these are an ancient, proud tribe of Arabs, or a nomadic tribe, and there are about 40,000 Bedouin on the West Bank, and there are about 27,000, according to just an internet search, under Israeli military control. All right, so now I'm with them, and I'm in one of the new towns being constructed by the Israelis because of their agricultural policy. Now, their agricultural policy is based on beliefs, not on science. And that was what I discovered in 1960, and which made me so unpopular. So the belief, to make it simple, is that when deserts are being caused, it is the nomads, the shepherds, and too many sheep. You can go back in ancient biblical texts, I'm told, and read that. There is no science behind that. That's a belief that we found was flawed in 1960. So here we are with the Israeli government enforcing destocking and removing the Arabs' sheep, the Bedouin. Now, how do the Bedouin men, an ancient, fierce tribe, how do the men support their families when their whole culture is based on sheep and the government has removed their sheep? Well, they can't. Now, you're going to get violence. So to stop that, what the Israeli government have done in this policy is they've built towns, totally artificial towns, and put the Arabs in it, the Bedouin. And as the mayor told me, he said, now our men are paid an allowance to support their families based upon the number of children they have. Well, if you put men in a town without their sheep and you pay them for the number of children they have, what the hell do you think they're going to do?
They're going to breed. Yeah.
the mayor said to me, Alan, what do you think the average age of my citizens in my town is? Because he said, I'm the mayor of the youngest town in the world in citizens. And I said, I have no idea. Tell me, average age of his citizens, 12 years old. Now, all that is just building up for violence. If I was a Bedouin, you would make me a guerrilla. You would make me a guerrilla fighter with that policy. Now, there's absolutely no need of it. We could take those Bedouin, based entirely on science and not beliefs, totally proven stuff. Not a single scientist in the world has proved this wrong in any way in the last 60 years. We could take those Arabs, we could double, treble, and more their number of sheep, and it would heal the desert. And it would make friends of all of them. And that is a military agricultural government policy, creating enemies.
Right. How similar is that situation to the situation in Rhodesia, where the government advocated for the culling of tens of thousands of elephants? Were there belief or policy, were there belief systems in that instance that were also creating that policy?
Absolutely, and I was guilty. And of the hundreds, probably thousands of scientists involved and institution, I was the only one that said we were wrong. It got worse. So yes, I did the research and I did what all scientists do. We tend to see the data that fits our belief, and the data that doesn't fit our belief, we become blind to, because we're human. That's a human trait.
Right.
And so when I was seeing severe damage in national parks, I did the research and easily established this is too many elephants, too many buffalo, too many eland. We're going to have to cull and reduce the population and bring it down to a level the environment can sustain. Now, that was political dynamite, the idea of reducing animal numbers in future national parks. And so my work was checked by a committee, peer-reviewed, headed by Dr. Oliver West and Ray Smithers, people I knew, good people. They inspected my work in the field. They looked at all my research. They agreed with me. We were all wrong, because the government went ahead and shot 40,000 elephants based on my research. And the situation got worse. And as we speak today, it is still getting worse. And government and institutions have never admitted error and have no solution to this day. So yeah, that was based on beliefs, and I was the guilty guy that initiated it.
You wonder, in your 2013 TED Talk, you talked about 10,000 years of pastoral care, followed by 100 years of modern science that have really only made desertification worse. And I'm curious as to your perspective about at what point and why there was this shift potentially in disregarding tens of thousands of years of pastoral management of land to now believe in a management system that did not have that same sort of longevity and insisted that the problem was the number of animals on the land instead of the length of time, essentially, that they were on a particular piece of land. Like what about that shift might have, in your opinion, caused that practice change?
Well, really what happened, it was longer than 10,000 years, because as far as we know, we would have domesticated animals somewhere perhaps 15,000, 20,000 years ago. By 10,000 years, because of the domesticated animals, the way they were managed, we were seeing cities fall under desert sands. So there had to be a long time before that. Now, all those early people were closer to a solution. They saw their connection to the land. Their whole culture was their livestock entirely. And so because the domestication of the animals and changing their behavior was leading to the desertification, it was extremely gradual. And with all the pastoral communities around the world, it is still continuing. The land is degrading despite all the TV programs and everything you see. But it's a very, very gradual thing. So it's taken thousands of years. In Australia, where they didn't have the livestock, it took roughly 50,000 years, because it actually began before domesticating livestock when we acquired fire. Now, that gradual process, when we had modern science and scientists, we said these people have got too many animals. We have to have grazing systems. We have to have fencing. And then fencing came in. Not only did it change the military when barbed wire literally killed the cavalry, because you couldn't charge through barbed wire against machine guns of soldiers in trenches, but the military had to go right into the Second World War. And a friend of mine actually led the last charge of the Indian Army cavalry. His entire squadron was wiped out, but he was still proud of it. And even when their horses were taken away, he rode next to an armored car. He wouldn't get in it, but they still had the name cavalry. So you have this deep emotion and tie. Yeah. So we got scientists coming in, barbed wire coming in. It didn't just change the military. It changed the way we managed land. And so we started distributing livestock lighter on the ground, believing there were too many, distributing them. And we were changing their behavior even faster. So the rate of desertification, for instance, in the middle of Texas, is 10, 20 times faster than under previous nomadic tribes. Now, I got good evidence of that from Bob Steger. I don't know if Bob's still alive and really listening, but Bob, when he was training with me, he was a professor at Angelo State University. And one day he said to me, Alan, by the way, you're right. He said, I've got the official USDA stocking rate 100 years ago at San Angelo. And we looked at it and it looked like science fiction today. Today, there are almost no cattle on the land in Texas. The numbers are so low. And that rate of desertification far worse than anything I've seen in Africa. So yeah, it accelerated with our narrowly trained experts having no ecological understanding of the whole complexity. But these are the things that far-sighted bureaucrats in the USDA worked with me, and we solved, as I said earlier, 1983 when I published the textbook.
How you begin to change these processes Ashby's work.
Thank you. So what Eric Ashby found, and expressed it in English terms, he said, when you reach the point where the people at the cricket ground in the pub are saying, when the hell is the government going to change, or when the hell is the army going to change, or the university going to change, or the environment going to change, then they change. And that can take up to 200 years. Do remember that it took brilliant officers in the Royal Navy 200 years to accept that lime juice would stop scurvy, even though the empire was dependent on the Royal Navy. And then it took the merchant navy another 70 years, and nothing has changed since. I mean, what I'm talking to you today has been known. I have tried to talk to think tank people at Sandhurst. I've tried to get connection with think tank people at West Point. They just cut me off as a crank. I've finally given up. I don't know how. I don't know how to get through to think tank people in the two best colleges I know, military colleges. You can't even talk to them. So once we get this expertise, you have a real problem. Now that became worse in Napoleon's time. Now there's a whole bestseller book written about it by John Ralston Saul. And what Saul did is he wrote a book, Voltaire's Bastards, and that's what it's called. And effectively what happened was, way back in Voltaire's time, they were getting major blunders in the world, and they did not want those to continue. The Boston Tea Party, the East India Company had its own judges, was passing death sentences, had an army bigger than Britain's, standing army. I mean, these things had to stop, these stupidities. And the best minds in the world at the time said, well, why is this happening? And they decided it was because of amateurism, because you could buy or inherit your position in the army, the navy, the parliament, the corporation, the church in those days. So they said, we've got to have professionalism. And from there on, the age of reason, etc., all institutions would be headed by highly trained, academically trained, qualified people. Now, today, I don't think you could be head of an environmental organization without a PhD, academic qualification,
sure,
almost anything. And sure. So that was to end the blundering. So what Saul did was said, well, let's study it. We've had a lot of time. Napoleon spread that through Europe more than any other leader. That's how armies, universities, everything's run today. And so he said, let's study it. and see if the blundering increased or decreased. What
And
do you
did
think?
it? And did it increase or decrease?
What do you think? With climate change, Vietnam War, the chaos, the international arms trade, where the hell did that come from? It came from a brilliant mind, McNamara, when he was head of the Pentagon, and America had the great expense of developing new military technology. He came up with a brilliant idea. Well, we can finance this by selling arms. And so America began to sell arms to finance that, based on a brilliantly highly trained person. He's used as an example in the book. And so the French said, that's a good idea. The Chinese said, that's a good idea. The Russians said, that's a good idea. The British said, that's a good idea. Now the international arms trade is one of the biggest in the world, totally unproductive for humans. And that came from a brilliant mind running the Pentagon. And that you can read the book about it. So yeah, there's a real problem with narrowly trained expertise. But please believe me, I don't criticize anything or anyone without a way forward, a constructive way forward. And that's why I gave a short 12-minute talk at COP26 on this issue when I was invited to talk in a small sideshow with two other people about regenerative agriculture, because that underlies everything. And I made constructive suggestions there. So I hope in a talk like ours that some of the military people, ex-military people, will start to take an active interest in agriculture and the root cause of almost all the violence that follows from environmental degradation, Arab Spring, it's just over and over again. This mass emigration from desertifying North Africa that is changing the political face of Europe, etc. Mm-hmm. It's all mm-hmm. just got an agricultural base. So I hope more people in the military at any level, past or present, will start to open their eyes and become more inquisitive.
Yeah. What did you propose to West Point, and why did they, what did they say back to you after that proposal?
Well, to both Sandhurst and West Point, all I tried to do was find people in Washington or in Kenya or wherever who had close ties, any ties at all, to say, please just have them talk to me. If they have a think tank or anything, simply have them talk to me. That's all I proposed.
About
and
what?
I just got brushed off as a crank.
Talk to you about what?
About what we're talking about. The military colleges have absolutely no idea what the root cause of biodiversity loss, land degradation, habitat degradation, social breakdown, violence. They have no idea of the root cause of it. So our military colleges are supporting the cause of the violence they end up handling. Now, if you've got think tanks and thinking, deep thinking people, I just suggested, please talk to me, because I've worked on this problem for 70 years.
Right. And your position is that if we can solve the root cause of it, then these sort of senseless conflicts could potentially be avoided altogether.
No, not quite right, Mike. We did solve the root cause of it in 1983. 2,000 scientists and academics that I was commissioned to put through training. What we need now is to do it.
What happened with that initiative? Why don't you think that if this training event occurred in 93 with 2,000 of these great scientists with the solution, why do you think that it's not in full scale implementation today?
All right, let me explain that to you. In the world, we produce millions of things. We produce beef, wine, cheese, cell phones, bombs, music, art, literature. We produce them. We don't manage them. If you stop producing, they stop. All the technology, the cars, the computers, if the battery runs out, power runs out, they stop. Okay, so none of those are managed. So what do we manage? We only manage three things. We manage our families, and at scale our institutions. And the first thing they have to do is to finance themselves. And then we manage nature to produce everything that makes civilization possible. So we only manage three things. Now, in the 1980s, we found there were two glitches in how we manage those three things. The whole world still believes we manage millions of things. No, we don't. And we learned that long ago. Now, one of the things we managed is institutions. Now, institutions are what we call complex. They take on a life of their own when they're developed, and they reflect the beliefs of the society in which they developed. That's why Lord Ashby's research said it takes anywhere up to 200 years before an institution changes. Millions of individuals have to change. Now, when we discovered in 83 what was causing it, the agreement I had with government was that they commissioned me to put 2,000 scientists through training via the SAS. We had an interagency committee. And if there was a big demand for this training, then the government would take over my work and I could return to my country. I wasn't an American. I was an exile, political exile, yeah. So that was the agreement, and interagency committee ran the whole thing. I just did the training. Now, we developed and we broke through in that period. Now, the demand was great. The US Forest Service alone were requesting training 18,000 people. And then we got notified that it was likely to be shut down. And shortly after it was, Wilson Scaling from Texas was appointed to head the SCS, and all future training was banned. Now, why would an institution behave like that? They always have for thousands of years. Now, a lot of people will doubt that, and I can understand that. So let me tell you about an incident I had recently. I was talking to two young men back in my own country, both well-educated, coming from wealthy families, both university degrees, and they said to me, "Alan, we've been watching you all our lives. What you say is such common sense, and yet we've seen you opposed by our governments, our organizations, our universities, etc." And they said, "You must be doing something wrong." And I said, "Yeah, I know I am. And I've had many people tell me that, but I've had nobody tell me how to do it right. I don't know how you get new thinking into society in a short time." And I said, "What about you guys?" And they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, how are you doing?" And they said, "We don't understand you." And I said, "Well, look at you. You look like Christians to me, are you?" And they said, "Yes, we're Christians." And I said, "Well, what do you think? What did your founder have to say? Didn't he talk about love and caring? Isn't that simple?" And I said, "For 2,000 years, how many millions and millions and millions of Christians in their families, in their communities, have been capable of love and caring? Millions." And I said, "What happened when you took it to scale? The moment you managed religion at scale?" I said, "You formed over 2,000 branches of Christianity, Christian churches. You've been going to war, fighting each other, killing each other, maiming each other." I said, "It was Christians who carried out the Holocaust." And I said, "You have major churches that protect pedophile priests. Is that what your founder said?" And they said, "Oh my God, no." I said, "It's a common problem to all institutions. They take on a life of their own. They have to finance themselves, etc. And they have to survive. And they cease to be what they were intended." So we now, again, I don't criticize without constructive solution. In what I suggested in the COP26 talk, we have a way of solving that, because we have to have our institutions. We cannot manage without them, and they are our most efficient way of doing things. But we also need to acknowledge that they have what are called wicked problems, almost incapable of solving. So we have to now acknowledge that and work out how to deal with it, so that we don't have our institutions taking us to war.
Couple things there. I'm sorry, you might have said it, but I think I missed it. What institution banned that work for these scientists in the early 80s?
What?
What institution came down and banned that training?
The very institution that commissioned me to do it, the Soil Conservation Service, USDA. They
Why?
commissioned me to do, they
Why do you think they
commissioned,
banned it?
oh, there's no mystery at all. When we put the 2,000 people through training, each training, I just put them in a horseshoe. And so these are men and women coming with PhDs, some are professors from universities, from all the government agencies, some from World Bank, US Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM, BIA, the whole lot. And I would just say, let's start introducing ourselves. We're going to be working for a week together on a new framework for management. And let's introduce ourselves. And we go around, and somebody like you might say, I'm Mike Disser. I'm married. I've got two kids and a dog. And somebody else would introduce themselves, and somebody else. And then somebody would not introduce themselves. They would tell you how important they were. They would say their name, and they would say, I have two PhDs. I've published 50 papers. I'm cited in so many papers. I'm head of range science at such and such a prestigious university. They would tell you nothing about themselves as humans. They had clearly pinned their self-esteem to their status. And that was a red flag to us, our interagency committee. So when we went through the training, we had one thing that was anything goes. I didn't want us to be wrong at all if we could avoid it. So 1 hour was devoted every day to nothing but what I called anything goes. So we have an hour now, ladies and gentlemen, and it is our duty. We have to find some flaw in the logic of what we're doing or in the science. And you do that with 2,000 people over 2 years. My God, you find the problems. We ended up to make it fun offering a $1,000 prize if somebody could find a flaw in the logic or the science, and they couldn't. Now, when we were doing that, those people who had pinned their self-esteem, all right, when we had those anything goes things, they would never even try to attack the logic or the science. They would attack me, my motive, my English accent, the cap I wore. It was just endless, just personal attacks. And it was the knowledge that was spreading that. Because they were saying, oh my God, I've earned all this recognition and status, and the direction was that way. How do they face it? So I can empathize with them. I mean, I had to face that when I recognized I was wrong and say, so either I'm a scientist or I'm going to run my life on my goddamned ego. And I decided, no, I'm a scientist. Ego has to go by the board. If you're wrong, say so. They can't do that. So what they
So,
did was they had the training banned.
because it protected the reputation that they had built their professional careers on, and
Oh,
that it is
don't forget, whole countries have gone to war over
sure.
one man's ego.
Right.
And long
Right.
ago,
Right.
we had an international trial in Rhodesia. It came out in my favor, and it bounced back, and I got banned from setting foot on any campus of any university for over 20 years. So it had a very reverse thing. The agreement of the government would have been if this trial came out confirming what I said, we would change the teachings, the extension office, everything. So it was reverse. And we were having a discussion about that with some thinking Rhodesians. And one said to me, Alan, were you up against vested interest? And I thought of vested interest as financial. And so I said, no, because to this day, no corporation, no financial vested interest has ever opposed me. To this day, 60 years later, or whatever. And there was somebody in the group, a farmer there, who said, Alan, you're wrong. And I said, oh, enlighten me then. I don't understand. And he said, you're up against the biggest vested interest in the world. And I said, I have no idea what that is. He said, professional people's egos. He said, you've just done an international trial and in effect shown how clever you were and how stupid they were. What did you expect? That was a big lesson to me. I'd never seen that our professional egos are a bigger vested interest than financial, but they are.
In that COP26 talk that you just referenced, you advocated for institutions, but at the same time, we're now saying that institutions in certain ways can be corrupted by the egos of the people that manage those institutions. So if we need institutions to be at least be a part of this problem, of this solution, how do we build them in such a way that they are not corrupted by personal ego?
First, you do need them. Institutions inevitably have wicked problems. Even my own institution, Slavery Institute, we face the same issue. So we have to be on guard all the time doing what we can because we are an institution. So we have to have them. So in the what I proposed at COP26, the skill lies in the facilitation. How do you facilitate a government developing policy from which laws, regulations, taxation, everything flows? How do you facilitate a government doing that and simultaneously managing the complexity of culture, society, institutions that are going to develop the policy, financing themselves, and managing nature to produce whatever that government does? And it doesn't matter whether it's a defense policy, a COVID policy, an agricultural policy, but let's talk agriculture for the moment. So that skill, I said, we would provide Slavery Institute, because we've been working on this problem, as I said to you, for 70 years. And we know that governments do not have that skill, unfortunately. Now, what would happen is, and what I suggested, is any sovereign state, it could be a state, it could be a country, whatever, is if the leader will just carry on as they are, because the public expects it, everything, but act as a statesman or stateswoman, and on the side as concurrent activity, just have the citizens develop a policy with our facilitation help. Now, roughly how that would work is, if any of the listeners think about it, how's a policy developed today? Well, let's say it's you and you had a government agency, you're a prime minister or you're a president or whatever, and you decide to develop a policy. We can absolutely guarantee, because it's never changed in a million years, every human decision is made to meet a need, a desire, or address a problem. Every human, that's we discovered in 1983. All right, so you will do that. Now, that is your political party that is going to develop the policy. All right, so let's first look at your political party. It is an institution. Its first duty is to maintain support of people and finance. If the party goes broke, it's out. All right, so its second, as very much part of that, is to absolutely ensure the support of the people. All right, because its third priority is to stay in power. If the political party is out of power, it's out of action. Well, so they see it. So it's got three top priorities. Now, the fourth priority is the interests of the citizens. All right, so now that political party calls together the experts in, say, agriculture or defense or whatever it is. They call together the experts. Now, who do they call together as experts? They do their best. They're sincere. Most people are doing their best. And what they do is they, what you find that the people who come are experts from the university on agriculture, experts from the farming organizations, expert economists, whatever. And so these people come in. Every one of them is paid a salary by an institution. It's extremely rare to have an independent scientist there not paid by an institution. It almost never happens. All right, so every institution that comes to develop the policy and help the government follow the same thing. It's an institution. It has to maintain itself. It's not a human being. It's an organization. It has to finance itself and keep money. It has to have, if it's a corporation, market share, whatever it is. So you have two or three top priorities for that institution. Its third or its fourth priority, if you're lucky, is the interests of the citizens. So every party developing policy has third or fourth priority, the interests of the citizens. You've got a big problem right there that we need to neutralize, and we do that through the facilitation process. Now, let's look at another aspect of that. Every expert that came, and this I'll guarantee you, was an expert in a form of production, how to produce food, how to produce energy from nuclear, wind, solar, whatever, how to run an economy, blah, blah, blah. They're experts in their field. And you remember I talked about Saul and how the experts lead to greater blundering. It's because we're managing complexity. So none of them who come to develop the policy have expertise on how you simultaneously manage the culture, the people, their institutions, of which you're part of one, that have to finance themselves first before they manage nature to produce everything that sustains civilization. So it would be a miracle if our policies weren't leading to ever-increasing chaos. Take COVID. COVID broke out. In 4 months, it did more global economic damage, apparently, than World War II did in 4 years when I was growing up. How the hell can a COVID, a virus, do more global economic damage than a world war and do it in 4 months? That's not possible. So what the hell did the damage?
Decisions that we made on the back of that.
No, not the decisions we make. You'll never change human decision-making. What did the damage was the way that governments develop policies, which I've just outlined to you. That's what did the damage.
If the Savory Institute is coming in to provide the skill and the faculties to execute on this holistic practice, I would assume still that the Savory Institute would be paid to come in and provide those faculties and training. So,
yeah, let's get that clear. If a government somewhere decided to develop policy in the interests of the citizens primarily, yes, we could provide the facilitation skill. We would not come in to execute policy, as you said. We would not develop the policy. We would purely provide the facilitation skill to show the experts of that country, the citizens of that country, there's a specific way it's done, to show them, all right, how to develop the policy in the interests of the citizens that will lead to the lives that the citizens want, tied to their life-supporting environment that is not degrading and leading to poverty and violence.
And so long as they carried out that process in the way that was educated to them and did not allow egos or human decision-making to corrupt that, then in theory, it would lead to the outcomes that you've described.
Well, Mike, the ego part of it we neutralize, and the expert part of it we neutralize in the facilitation process, because please believe me, most people are good. They're brilliant minds in our universities. We have masses of knowledge and all of that. So all that is neutralized. Now, when, as I suggested there, when a government develops policy in this way on the side, just observing it, all right, now they can accept it or not. I'm not even saying you must accept it. I'm saying just try something never been done before in the history of the world and try on the side to see if you can address policy in a different way. That will literally address the root cause of almost everything that ails us.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Alan Savory. And if you've made it this far, you already know that it was not a surface-level conversation. From his time as a military officer tracking guerrilla fighters in Rhodesia, to calling out the flawed ecological assumptions that led to his participation in the culling of 40,000 elephants, Alan has spent a lifetime challenging the status quo. He reminded us that bad policy built on bad assumptions doesn't just damage land, it destabilizes societies. And that agriculture isn't just a sector, it's the foundation for civilization, national security, and peace. If any of that resonated with you, stay tuned. In part two, we go deeper into his holistic management framework, the controversy around livestock and climate, and how regenerative practices, done right, can turn deserts green and food systems resilient. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike DeSau, and until next time, stay frosty.